nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Kind of want to know. Okay. So now question is, where do you get the density of states? Well, experimentally, you try to measure them. The way you measure it is by photoemission spectroscopy and a host of other experiments. Now, lately what we have been talking about a little bit has to do with understanding what exactly energy levels mean, in the sense that, you see, you calculate these energy levels from a Schrodinger equation, as we have discussed. And Schrodinger equation for the hydrogen atom, of course, is very simple, in the sense that you just have a nuclear potential to worry about, and that's a problem that you can solve exactly. But as soon as you have systems with more than one electron, then conceptually even, it gets a little tricky to understand what energy levels really mean. That is, supposing you have this atom or a solid with hundreds of electrons all interacting. And so there's a lot of interaction energy, which really doesn't belong either to this electron or to that electron. So what exactly does it mean when you draw an energy level here and you say that an electron can be put into that level? And the point I wanted to stress is that the way you should interpret it is, again, think back as to how you actually measure it experimentally. Experimentally, the way you measure this level, for example, is by seeing what energy it takes to knock one electron out of the system. And so that energy level kind of represents the difference between an n-electron system and an n-1-electron system. The difference is what you are seeing there. And to bring that out, the last few lectures we have been kind of talking about this multi-electron picture. The one that's really gives you a more complete view of what's how to think about it really. It's just that it's not very convenient to use directly. But what we tried to do was show how you could use that to calculate current voltage characteristics of small tanks. Yes, please. Experimentally. When it's something really small, like a hydrogen atom, I guess you know what you're talking about. When it is a big piece of solid, then it's really the difference, as you know. I mean, you can't be quite sure exactly what number it is often. Now, so it's the differences we are talking about. So the question is, what does it take to add an electron? What does it take to take out an electron? Well, normally it would be neutral, right? Hydrogen. So for example, today we'll talk a little bit about the hydrogen molecule, let's say. So that would be, you know, when it's neutral, it's got two electrons. If you knock one electron out, it would be one electron. But normally it wants to be neutral, right? No. Okay, so now one point, for example, that I tried to stress is that, let's say even the hydrogen atom, when you solve this equation, you'd find the lowest level, let me just draw this here, the lowest level of a hydrogen atom would be this 13.6 eV. Let's call that E0. And there's the vacuum level, so that's minus 13.6 eV. So that's this 1s level of a hydrogen atom. Okay. Now, these levels always come in pairs, so you've got two levels there. Technically. Now, if you were actually doing this kind of an experiment with something that small, and you draw a level here, and you've got two levels there, and let's say you got one electron in here, that's the hydrogen atom. Now you think that you can add another electron into that level. After all, that one's empty. But the point is, not really, because one electron's already there. To add a second electron really requires a whole lot more energy. So conceptually, actually, that level's really not there. It's somewhere up there. Why is that? Well, you see, if you're talking about adding a electron to a hydrogen atom, then you're talking of going from a one-electron system to a two-electron system. And when you try to add the second electron, it will feel a potential due to the other electron. So what you should be solving is not the Schrodinger equation with just the nuclear potential, but also including a potential due to that electron that's already there. And if you did that, of course, you'd have found a level that was much higher up, really, etc. So these kinds of things, the smaller the system we are talking about, the more important it kind of gets. Because a hydrogen atom is so small that just adding one presence of one electron kind of pushes that level up by like 10 volts. But that's the hydrogen atom. That's about the smallest thing we are talking about. Whereas if it's bigger things, like that are hundreds of angstroms, then it's not 10 volts. It's maybe 100 millivolts, 1/10 of a volt or less. But the thing is, if it's comparable to KT, that means it will affect current voltage characteristics. You'll see some effect of it. And that was kind of what I tried to convey in the like this last set series, few lectures, that aspect of things. Now, today, we'll talk a little more about, you'll get a little bit more of this idea of this different types of energy levels, in the sense that when you draw energy levels, what exactly does it mean? What are energies? And especially, the question I want to talk about a little bit is, why do atoms want to form molecules? I mean, the generic answer is the energy becomes lower. I mean, everything, I mean, it's why do two hydrogen atoms combine to become a hydrogen molecule? Well, because the hydrogen molecule has lower energy than two hydrogen atoms. But the question is, what energy are we talking about? I mean, that energy is not quite these levels, because these levels are what it takes to knock an electron out. Whereas here we are talking about the total energy of the thing. See? And in this class, of course, we'll be talking about these energy levels because we are interested in current flow. We are talking about, and current flow always involves putting an electron in and taking it out. That's what current flow is about. So the question, the energies we are interested in is, what does it take to add an electron? What does it take to take out an electron? On the other hand, if this was a course in material science, that is, okay, given these atoms, what kind of molecules will it form? What kind of solid structure would silicon want to form? Then we'd be really talking about the total energy of the system. Because why does silicon form a particular crystal lattice? Well, because that crystal lattice gives it the lowest total energy. So if this was a course in material science, all we'd be talking about is total energy, which is different from those energy levels. You see, and this is the thing that I wanted to kind of get clear, that all these, when you draw energy, there's all kinds of energies one could be talking about. And this is a very special kind that we use for describing current flow and how we measure it. Okay. Now, one thing we had discussed is that based on the Schrodinger equation back in the 50s, you know, by 1960 or so, people had managed to more or less solve for the energy levels for all the atoms in the periodic table and compare them with experiment, and they agreed very well. Okay? And as you know, this periodic table, this, it goes from like the atomic number of 1, 2, 3, all the way up, and 1 is this hydrogen, 2 is helium, and that's the 1s levels. Then you go to the 2 levels, and that's when you go from Z equals 3 all the way down to 10, because it takes 8 electrons to fill up the second shell. I think the 3 is lithium. This last one's probably neon. Okay. Then you go on to the next one, 11, that's like sodium. And then you go down, you know, 10, 18, and then 19, 20. Now that's where things get a little complicated, because you go in and fill up all the 10D levels. That's this 20, 21 to 30. And then you start off again with 31, 32, etc. And down to, I think, 36 or so. This is the, I guess, the inert gases, etc. So this we talked about a little bit. Now, what I want to say, talk a little bit about today is how these things form molecules. Because what we're really interested in is solids, but then solid is kind of like a very big molecule in a way. Now, there's one kind of bonding. I mean, this process of elements coming together to form molecules, that's what you call bonds, forming bonds. Now, there's one kind of bonds that's relatively simple to understand. And that's what I would call the ionic bonding. And the reason is ionic bonding basically arises from the fact that when you go down any row, if you look on this side, the energy levels are relatively higher than on the other side. Why is that? Well, because when you go from this one to the next one, you've got one more extra positive charge in your nucleus, and then one more positive charge in your nucleus. And so when you actually solve the Schrodinger equation with those extra positive charges, you actually end up gradually lowering the, giving a more and more negative energy. Because of that, that positive charge, of course, gives you a negative potential there. It's minus ZQ square over 4 pi epsilon 0 r. So the bigger the Z, the more negative this gets. And so if you look at energy levels across any row, it will want to go from high to low. So what that means is that if you bring them together for something from the left-hand side and something from the right-hand side, the one electron from here will want to go over there. So the classic example of that is sodium and chlorine. Sodium's from this side, chlorine's from that side. And there's one electron here, it goes over to that, it becomes Na plus Cl minus, classic example of ionic bonding. It's a little more complicated in detail, but in essence, it's something like this. But what this doesn't explain, though, is covalent bonding, which is the most common type of bonding, and which is, of course, operative in all the semiconductors we're interested in. You know, carbon, it forms graphene or graphite, diamond, silicon, all of this. That's what's called covalent bonding. And the best example of that is just how hydrogen forms a molecule. Just why do two H atoms want to form a H2 molecule? Because these are identical things. So there's no good reason why they would want to stay together. No, not that an electron's getting transferred. I mean, after all, the same energy level. No particular reason. So it's something a little more subtle. Okay, now, the way this works is that if you bring two hydrogen atoms together, so one of them has a level like this, E0 minus 13.6 eV, and then you got another one. Same level, at the same energy. So these are the two hydrogen atoms. So you have a nucleus here, and you have a nucleus here. Now, the generic reason why it forms a molecule, of course, is that the overall molecule has a lower energy. Question is why? Because you'd say, well, I got one electron here, I got one electron there. Bring them together, so what? Well, the thing is that if you bring them a little closer together and you want to find the new energy levels, what you should be doing is solving the Schrodinger equation not with just one nuclear potential, but with two nuclear potentials. So you should be solving the Schrodinger equation with something like this. You know, this is the potential that the electron sees due to this nucleus. That's the potential the electron sees due to that nucleus. And so the overall potential looks something like this. And then you solve Schrodinger equation in there. And the important thing is, and this at this time I'm just stating it, I guess next day, I think we'll actually have a model for it where you'll see why, well, you'll get a little better insight why this happens. But the basic fact is that if these two things are far apart, then you'd get one level here and one level there. That's pretty clear. I mean, after all, that's like solving two separate Schrodinger equations. But if you bring them together, then when you solve the levels, you'd actually get one level that's a little lower and another one that's a little higher. And each one, of course, again, has an upspin and a downspin that go together. So there'll be one a little lower and the one a little higher. Okay? That's not meant to be obvious. As I say, next day when I discuss this a little more, it might get a little clearer. We'll talk on it. But this is then, at this time, let's just accept this as a fact that if I solve that equation with these things a little closer together, as you bring them together, this will get lower. So the closer I bring, the lower this will get, and the more higher that will get. So they'll keep going down, and this will keep going up. So in fact, if you actually plotted this thing, so this is E0. So let me call this EB. This is the new energy I get by solving this hydrogen, the Schrodinger equation with two nuclear potentials, call that EB. So if you plot EB minus E0, I meant EB minus E0 on this axis, and this is R, which is the distance between the two nucleus. That's all. So as R gets smaller and smaller, this difference gets bigger and bigger. In other words, that level goes down. So this I'm just stating as a fact. Okay. As I said, not meant to be immediately obvious or anything. The nearest analogy I can say is that if you had two LC circuits and each had a resonant frequency and they were kind of coupled together, so each LC circuit has a resonance like this, but when you bring them together, you tend to develop two peaks, one a little below and a little above. Anytime you take two resonant systems and couple them together, you get these two peaks, one a little below, one a little above. So in a way, this is kind of the same way. Hydrogen atom has a resonance here, hydrogen atom has a resonance there. Bring them together, there's one peak a little lower, one peak a little higher. That's about the simplest thing I can say, you know, without going into any more detail about this. Okay. But the point is, that I'm trying to make is, that because these have a lower energy than that, you see, you can now see why two hydrogen atoms would want to form a molecule. I mean, how that would lower the energy. The idea is, you see, as long as the hydrogen atoms are separate, there's one electron sitting here, one electron sitting there. But now, I could have one electron sitting here and one electron sitting there. You see? So overall, it looks like that the energy has been lowered because you could take both of them and put them there. Now, this kind of thing, you see, it's helping only because you have what you might call a half-filled situation. Namely, the hydrogen atom here had two levels but had only one electron in them. Because supposing we talk about helium atoms, you can see this method wouldn't work at all because a helium atom has two electrons to start with. So you bring another helium, it's also got two electrons in it. So when you bring them together, you got four electrons to accommodate. And so this level goes down, that goes up. So you put two here and you put two there. Well, you have gained nothing because, you know, these got a little lower energy, but those picked up more energy, and overall you haven't gained much. So this kind of thing wouldn't work at all for helium, and it really works best when you start with something that is half-filled. And that's why, you know, with hydrogen it works very well. And again, in this periodic table, it works best when you're somewhere in the middle here. For example, on this row, 6 is carbon. 14 is silicon. So all the classic semiconductors are kind of that way. 32 is germanium. All of these kind of have this property that in this outer shell, where there are actually 8 levels, but it's like there's only half that many electrons in there, etc. Okay, so the point then is that as you solve the Schrodinger equation, this level gets a little lower, and so this goes down. Now, what this doesn't explain, though, is that when you bring these hydrogen atoms together, why it doesn't just sit on top of each other? Because the fact is, of course, what's known experimentally. Again, these are all measured things that people have measured. That hydrogen molecule sitting by itself, that distance is approximately 3/4 of an angstrom, 0.74 angstroms. That's measured, known. But why doesn't it get smaller? Because if this was the case and the whole objective was to lower the energy, then you'd say, well, you know, keep getting closer. Why not? And the answer is that, you see, we haven't quite accounted for all the energies in this discussion. Because the way you have to think about it is, you see, I got two nucleus, let me call it N and N prime, and I got two electrons, E and E prime. Now, when you have two hydrogen atoms, then the energy of a hydrogen atom is the interact just by itself would be like n comma e or n prime comma e prime. So that's the energy of two hydrogen atoms separate. So, you know, these are two separate things. This, whatever the energy of this nucleus and electron system together is, whatever this one is together. Okay. Now we got the hydrogen molecule. And so there's all kinds of possibilities here, u, n, comma, n prime, e, comma, e prime. So, since there's two nucleus, n, n prime, and two electrons, e and e prime, I've just written down all the interaction energies, basically. Now, so when you are trying to figure out that whether hydrogen will want to form a molecule or not, the question is this lower than that? Like what we started with, n comma e, and where we are going, how does that look? And this is where, you see, when we take Schrodinger equation and put in this two nuclear potentials and calculate it, what you're really calculating is that quantity. That's what EB is. You see? Same with this. That's also EB. On the other hand, this is, of course, E0. This is what you got if you just solve the hydrogen atom by itself. And this also is E0. And so if you just look at this and say, well, this is lower than that, so the energy has been lowered by EB minus E0, twice that, you're kind of looking at the difference between this and that. But then you also have to worry about this part. There's also the interaction energies between the nucleus. The fact that when you bring them together, this positive charge and that positive charge, they see something. I mean, they repel each other. And the, of course, the electrons themselves are now seeing each other more, so there's the u, e, comma, e prime also. And so the point is that if you actually looked at these two things and added it to this, then the overall curve would have done something like that. That at low distances, it would have gone up, way up. And so there is actually an optimum distance that then minimizes the total energy, and that is the actual bond distance for hydrogen molecules. That's how you try to model. Now, the thing is, in order to calculate this, you just solve Schrodinger equation with two nuclear potentials. And we have talked about how, in principle, we do that. In detail, with atoms, we said that you could make use of the one-dimensional nature of the problem to solve it just on a computer very easily. With molecules, you don't quite have that. In detail, it may be a little more difficult. But in principle, you know, what we do is turn that into a matrix, find its eigenvalues, that kind of thing we have taught. This one's relatively easy because the nucleus is just two-point charges. So that's just freshman physics to write down the energy of two-point charges separated by r. That's it. That's straightforward. You know, it's just q squared divided by 4 pi epsilon 0, capital R. Okay. The hard one is this one. Because the electrons are not like one here and one there. It's like one electron is kind of all over the place. The other one's also all over the place. You don't quite know how it's distributed, so don't quite know how to calculate this till you know all their wave functions, etc. And so in general, that's what requires a serious, you know, self-consistent calculation and all that. So there's the hard one. But apart from those details, the point is that broadly what would happen is if you included all that, it would do this. and then this would be the bond length. And what people have done is, again, found different models for this, and they compare with experiment to see how well they can predict their bond length. And this is the point I always stress, that anything you do here is always kind of approximate. And so it's really very important always to validate and benchmark against real experiments. You know, so how good is your approximation? Well, can you explain this bond length correctly? Can you explain this dissociation energy correctly? Because this is, again, something that people measure experimentally. Namely, if you take a gas of hydrogen molecules and make it dissociate into hydrogen atoms, how much energy does it take? That's the dissociation energy. Again, you could do a Google search, dissociation energy of hydrogen molecules, you'll find all the numbers and the papers and, you know, where people have done all this. So theoretically, when you calculate it, you try to compare it against what's out there with the experimental numbers, and then that would tell you how good your model is doing, at least as far as that experiment is concerned. Yeah, one little thing I should point out is that when you're doing this kind of theory, you get the dissociation energy as a electron volt per molecule. Right? Because we usually calculate this energy, it would be, say, 1 or 2 EV or 5 EV per molecule, let's say. Whereas experimentally, when people measure it, and what you usually find if you looked up experiments, would be something that would be given in kilojoules per mole, or sometimes kilocalories per mole. And you'd have to convert from this to this in order to compare. Right? And how do you convert? Well, you see, from electron volts, how do you go to joules? You multiply by 1.6 times 10 to the power minus 19. If you have 1 EV, that's like 1.6 times 10 to the power minus 19th joules. Okay? So that's how you'd go from electron volts per molecule to joules per molecule. But then how do you go from joules per molecule to joules per mole? Well, a mole has an Avogadro number of molecules in it. So this is joules per molecule. So if you multiply by 6.023 times 10 to the power 23, that would then be joules per mole. This is joules per molecule. A mole has that many molecules, so this is joules per mole. So that's how you could go from one to the other unit-wise. And then to go from joules to calories, I believe it's like 4.2 joules make a calorie. Okay. That's just an aside. Now, in what we are interested in often is, as I said, current flow. That means we could say, I have a hydrogen molecule, and I'd like to know what energy it takes, what is the energy difference with, like, knocking one electron out of the hydrogen molecule. So what is the energy of E, like H2 plus, for example? So if I had to write, take this off. Just for reference, E0 was the level of a hydrogen atom, and then when you bring them together and calculate it with two nucleus, you get EB. And there's something else up here, doesn't matter, it's this one. And the B is for bonding, in the sense that, as I said, when two things form a bond, those electrons go into the lower level, so people call that the bonding level. That's all. Okay. So EB, that's E0. Okay. Now, the question we're asking is, what is the energy of a H2 plus, which means still got two nucleus, but it's got only one electron now. So U and N prime, that's still there. You've got two nucleus. No change. Is this one there? No, because we lost E prime, basically. So anything with an E prime in it is out. So what you're then left with is U N comma E plus U N prime comma E. So if you want to know what is the energy level that would correspond to like knocking an electron out? So you could say if EH2 minus EH2 plus. What is this energy difference? So here's the system with two electrons. Here's the system with one electron. So when that one electron goes away, how much energy does it leave with, essentially? And if it was actually in a device like this, whether it would be able to get away or not would depend on whether there were any energy levels with that energy available, empty. So it could get away there. Because if you had a hydrogen molecule sitting inside, and as I said, actually people have done experiments measuring the resistance of a hydrogen molecule, as small as that. The thing is, when you're taking an electron out, then the electron that leaves will leave with this much energy. Why? Because the system was here, and after the electron left, it had that energy. So what left must have taken away the difference. So now when you look at this difference, you can see NN prime is not important anymore. That's cancelled. But what you have then is, I guess, U N comma E prime plus U N prime comma E prime. Actually, we could drop the E prime because whether it's this or that, it's really the same EB. It doesn't matter. But the thing is, you have to include EE comma E prime. That's the thing. And that, of course, I had stated before, that usually when you solve Schrodinger equation, you cannot just solve it with the nuclear potential. You also have to include the potential due to any other electron present. So hydrogen molecule has two electrons in it. So when you take out an electron, you know, if you really want that level, you should include the energy due to the other electron. And that's what this is saying, that if I just solve Schrodinger equation with nuclear potentials, I'll get EB. But then actual energy will be something different. In practice, you know, if you solve this, as I said, this is like minus 13.6 eV. If you solve the Schrodinger equation with these two nuclear potential, the answer you might get is about 15 eV below this somewhere. So another minus 15 eV below that. You know, so this is minus 13, this would be like minus 28 or 30. On the other hand, what it really takes to knock out an electron from a hydrogen molecule is only about 4 eV or so below. What's this extra 11 eV? Well, that's because of this extra term, in the sense that this is what you'd need to knock, you know, kind of both electrons out. But knock one electron out, it's really less. Okay. Okay, so this example I kind of like to go through to give you a feel for what exactly these energy levels mean. Because as I said, most of this course generally will be talking about these energy levels, the ones that you put in here. You know, and what they really mean is like, what does it take to take an electron out, or what does it take to put an electron in? Because that's what current flow is about. And that is kind of very different from like, what is the total energy? And again, depending on the questions you're interested in, you could be looking at this. As I said, you know, like for example, the kinds of questions you often address in quantum chemistry and in material science is, let's say, you know, this is very simple, like hydrogen molecule, but supposing you had water, so it's H2O. And again, experimentally, it's known that HOH does not form a linear molecule, it actually has an angle to it, some 110 degrees or so. So the question you could ask is, why is that? I mean, why doesn't it just do this? Well, the way a quantum chemist would answer that question is they would find the total energy of that one and the minimum value you get after adjusting bond lengths and all. And they would take total energy of that one, and then this would be a little lower than that, which would then tell them that left to itself, water would want to be this rather than that. But that's a whole different energy from what you want here to describe current flow. Because this involves what does it take to take out an electron, etc. Whole different thing. So, as I said, so most of the course it's about what it takes to take an electron out or put one in, but you should be aware of this general big picture of how that fits into the overall scheme of things. Okay. Okay. Now, one other point I want to make here is that there is this equilibrium bond length, which I said is like 3/4 of an angstrom in this case. So you have these two hydrogen atoms, which are separated by 0.74 angstroms. Now, that's of course the distance that minimizes this energy. But then, left to itself, it would kind of want to vibrate around that. Why is that? Because, well, it's like you could increase your, if you go this way, the energy increases a little bit. If it go this way, the energy increases a little bit. But then it's only at zero temperature that everything wants to go to its lowest energy. At any normal temperature, it goes, you know, goes a little higher than that, you know, with anything within a few kT, it vibrates around there. Okay. Now, the way people visualize this is, you see, if these atoms had been connected by a spring, then you know the energy of this mass and spring system would have looked something like this. Now, this is the distance between the two hydrogen atoms. And when you have a spring like this, as you know, if R is equal to, let's say, the standard length of the spring, there's no energy. Otherwise, it increases like a parabola. And the absolute value of this is not important. You could lower it and draw it any way you want. And the thing is that since this is a minimum, then the, if you, you can always kind of approximate with a parabola over a small enough range. That's like doing a Taylor expansion or whatever. And, but instinctively, you can see that any curve around a minimum, you could fit to some kind of a parabola. And as long as you don't go too far from that minimum, that would be a reasonable way to think about it. And so that's how people think about this, you see, is that as if this is hydrogen molecule, hydrogen atoms connected by this abstract spring. And what's the spring constant of that? And, you know, the spring constant is what determines how sharp this thing is. So that's, so what's the spring constant? Well, that's where people experimentally try to get a feeling for this curve. Or theoretically, you'd calculate this energy and try to find the curvature of that and fit it to some k, if you're doing it theoretically. Experimentally, what you'd do is you'd measure the resonance frequency of this thing. Resonance frequency meaning that you see, you have k, and then you have these masses. And of course, one of the first things you learn in freshman physics is that if you have masses connected by springs, they have a resonant frequency like square root k over m. And so same here, that this thing has a certain resonance frequency. And if you hit it with some AC excitation with that right frequency, you know, usually this would require infrared frequencies, then it would resonate and it would respond very strongly. So you could see at what energies, when you hit it, it actually absorbs a lot of energy, and that will then tell you what the right resonance frequency is. And this is again something people have measured. People have measured these resonance frequencies for all kinds of bonds, and that's a widely used as a diagnostic tool. So nowadays, they would measure that resonance frequency and then look up a handbook to see which particular bond that fits, and then say, okay, that shows that you have something like that. So, you know, if you, do I have this particular bond in my sample? Well, if there's a resonance there and you match it against and you say, okay, that looks like it could be that. So, widely used for all kinds of things. And I guess, you know, although it's not quite vibrational frequency, but, you know, when in a microwave, when you heat up food, it's basically exciting resonances like this inside. So if the food kind of resonates with it and absorbs the energy, gets hot. It's about the same kind of idea. But the point is then that this is the way you kind of think of atoms in a molecule. That, yes, there is a specific distance, that's the bond length, but then it's as if they're connected by a spring. Some springs could be a little stiffer than others, but there is a spring you can think in terms of. And that's a fairly good way to think about it, as long as you are not going too far from equilibrium. As long as you're sticking here, because the spring, of course, is strictly a parabola, whereas the real thing isn't quite a parabola necessarily. if you go far. And this idea extends even when you go on to solids, because let's say we are interested in silicon as a solid. So you have all these silicon atoms. Arranged in some kind of a lattice structure, in this crystalline structure. You have silicon atoms in there. And as I said, you could view it almost as a very large molecule. But the thing is, these silicon are at certain fixed distances. Typically in solids, those distances would be 2 to 3 angstroms. But then the way you should think about it is there's springs connecting them, which means, again, only at zero temperature, they would be frozen stiff right where they are. But anytime you raise the temperature or at room temperature, these things are always jiggling around somewhat. And the higher the temperature, the more it jiggles around. Now, usually at room temperature, though, you are very far from the melting point. When you're very far from the melting point, it's not jiggling around a whole lot. In the sense I said, this distance is 2 angstroms. And if you find the root mean square amplitude of this vibration, that would possibly be like less than a tenth of an angstrom, much less probably. So it jiggles around just a little bit, but enough that it affects all kinds of things. You know, this is what you generally think of in terms of phonons of the structure. And they affect all kinds of things. As electrons try to go through it, they affect, you know, the electrons get knocked around because of that jiggling. In the sense, if they were frozen stiff, it would go straight through. But because it's jiggling, it affects how electrons flow through it, etc. But this idea that, you know, that there's kind of these invisible springs in there, that is a very general and powerful one. And experimentally, the way you check it, in a way, is, okay, assume a certain spring constant and see if you can predict the natural frequencies of this structure. And again, people who calculate this, there are people who do first principles theory, which means they would actually start from Schrodinger equation and try to calculate this curve and so on. But then lots of people do what's called molecular mechanics. There are all kinds of software available under the name molecular mechanics. What that means is, you say, well, you know, I've got a bond of this type, what's the equivalent spring constant? And then what you have is a network of springs and masses. And after that, you're just finding the resonant frequency of in a classical network of springs and masses, you know, which you, and then you, again, how good is that? Well, compare against experiments, see if you can adjust it to get them all right. Then there's something right about the model, and people do that. Now, what we'll be talking about next, and I guess the next few lectures, in a way, is to give you a feeling for how to obtain this density of states. Because as we discussed, current flow through anything, what you really want to know is where these energy levels are and how you model all that. And so in a way, what we'll be talking about is first the energy levels in molecules and solids, actually. We'll really talk about solids. And then how from that energy levels, you then can actually extract a density of states, how many states per unit energy. Those concepts, that's what we'll be talking about. Now, in order to talk about these energy levels, of course, when you are finding a theoretical model for it, of course, everything starts from Schrodinger equation, this business. And the only new thing, of course, relative to Schrodinger equation is the fact that ordinarily you'd have to include something due to the electrons. Now, one problem that you face as a practical matter is that as long as we were dealing with atoms, it had this spherical symmetry. And what that meant was that you could turn this into a one-dimensional Schrodinger equation, where there was only the radial coordinate involved. You didn't have to worry about angular coordinates at all. Right? It's just one coordinate. And as I said, as long as you're doing a one-dimensional problem, that's not too hard. On today's laptop, you can easily handle matrices that are a few hundred by a few hundred. And that is enough to do any 1D problem often. Okay. But the problem you have with a hydrogen molecule is just that right off the bat, you see, If your potential looks like this, you don't have that spherical symmetry anymore. And that's true in solids also. So it's not like I have a potential like this, and it is spherically symmetric. So all that matters is how far are you from the nucleus. So if you took the straightforward approach of doing this, the point is we don't cannot reduce it to a 1D problem. So you actually have to, it's like a full 3D problem. And that then would be very difficult to do directly. Difficult numerically. I mean, conceptually, about the same issues. Now, so that's why what people use, in essence, is something called these basis functions, which I'll explain, you know, after the break on Wednesday. We'll start with that. But the essence of all that is that whenever I want to turn this, whenever I want to solve this equation numerically, what I have to do always is turn it into a matrix equation. And how do you turn it into a matrix? What we talked about is one way of doing it was to assume a discrete lattice. And if you did that in this problem, then because it's this 3D problem and all that, you'd end up with a huge matrix. So instead, what people have widely used is a method, this the general concept of basis functions, where you can actually turn this into a matrix. And then if you have chosen your functions correctly, this can actually be a relatively small matrix. So for example, with a hydrogen molecule, you'll see you can get pretty good answers with just a 2x2 matrix. Nothing bigger than that. Okay. That's what I'll try to explain on Wednesday. And then the thing is that how do I find the elements of this matrix? Again, the correct way would have been to start from Schrodinger equation and then go through certain algebraic procedures to extract the elements of this matrix. But what is often done is people treat the elements of that matrix as experimentally adjusted parameters. Namely, people look at a few favorite experiments and see what parameters you need here to explain those. And then once you have got that, they use this to do all kinds of other things with it. Okay. So this is the approach that I'll be describing to you on Wednesday. And then the next few lectures, we'll talk about how to go from there to a density of states. That's kind of what we'll be doing the next couple of weeks.